Welcome to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. We speak with writers, thinkers, and newsmakers on the controversial issues of human life and human thriving that impact our daily lives. We are exceptional as creatures in the cosmos, as equal members of the human family, and as ethical beings. Humanize explores some of the fundamental questions. How do we thrive? How do we live well and care for what we've inherited? How do we act responsibly with one another and in the wider world? And how do we conserve the good things of this life for the future? We matter. Our actions matter. Let's get into it. I'm Wesley J. Smith, and this is Humanize. The creation of the modern hospice movement was a major advance in the care for people with terminal illnesses. Alas, in recent years, hospice has entered something of a crisis, with too many facilities offering inadequate care and some patients receiving short shrift of services to which they are entitled. To get to the bottom of the problem, I invited one of the movement's leading lights, Dr. Ira Byock, to discuss what has gone wrong with hospice and what can be done about it. Ira Byock is a leading medical authority, author, and public advocate for improving care for people living with serious medical conditions. He is an active emeritus professor of medicine and community and family medicine at Dartmouth's Geisel School of Medicine. He earned specialty certifications in family medicine, emergency medicine, and hospice and palliative medicine. Dr. Byock has been involved in hospice and palliative care since 1978. He is a past president of the Academy of Hospice and Palliative Medicine. In 2014, Dr. Byock founded the Institute for Human Caring within the multi-state Providence Health System. The Institute drives transformation to make caring for whole persons the new normal. He is the author of three books, including Dying Well, which became a standard in the field of hospice and palliative care. Dr. Byock lectures nationally and internationally and often appears in the media. This is his second appearance on this podcast. Ira, welcome to Humanize.
Thanks very much. It's nice to be back.
You've dedicated decades to the practice of medicine. Why did you want to become a physician?
You know, I wanted to be a physician, frankly, to serve people. It sounds maybe a little hokey at the moment, but I felt like I wanted to do something that was meaningful, that, you know, could support me and my family. And at the time, I was really committed to living in a rural area of the Rocky Mountains, and thought, what could I do to be of real service to people and earn a living while living in a place that would nurture me and a family? And it was clear. I mean, I spent a lot of time trying to think about what I wanted to be when I was growing up. And I went through college, more than halfway through college before I had any insights. Medicine was not what I thought I was going to do. But when one day I sort of set aside the assumption that I didn't want to go to school for the next, 10 years. And when I set that aside and said, okay, if I set that aside, now what would I want to do? It was like a thunderclap. And I thought, oh, I want to be a rural doc. That's what I want to do.
Sounds like you found your calling.
Yeah.
You entered the field of hospice and palliative care when it was in its early years. What interested you in that area of practice?
It wasn't in the plans. I really did think I was going to be a cradle-to-grave rural family doc. That's what I trained to do. But in the midst of my internship year in Fresno, California, in this kind of gonzo family practice program, I began having experiences that changed my career and, frankly, changed my life. This was Valley Medical Center in Fresno, a county hospital, public health hospital, serving mostly indigent people, many undocumented Spanish-speaking immigrants from Mexico. And the hospital, which was a UCSF affiliate, gave great care, but there was an absolute kind of lacuna when it came to people who we acknowledged were likely dying. Somehow, I mean, they were literally sent down the hall, you know, to rooms down the hall, ostensibly for their privacy, but we all knew it was because it was awkward to round on them, didn't feel like we had much to do for them. And it was, they were a reminder of our impotence in this regard. And that struck me at the time, Wes, as a kind of a failure of our commitment to excellence, but also as sort of a social injustice. Like when did they stop mattering? They're just folks. And so for whatever reason, I spent time with some of these dying people and didn't forget about them and managed their symptoms and the like. Well, I'm trying to shorten the story, but I remember a guy named Mr. Rodriguez who was dying of colon cancer. He had a liver full of colon cancer and jaundiced and often in pain, and we managed his symptoms. And one morning on rounds, I went to his room and crouched down to be at eye level. And I said, "Mr. Rodriguez, how are you doing today?" And he looked me straight in the face and said, "I'm well, doctor. How are you?" And I'm telling you, I leaned back and I had no idea what to say. Like, "I'm well, doctor." And my first thought was, "Oh, sure, it's the morphine, he's high. Or, you know, it's the steroids we've got him on. He's euphoric from his steroids." But I had to confront the possibility that he was choosing his words carefully, that he felt well within himself. And that sort of experience happened enough times over the next, you know, year or so, where, you know, I met a family who came back to the emergency department to talk to a social worker I was working with, and said, "You know, when we heard Mom was dying, it was the worst thing that could possibly have happened. But we've been at home with her for the last month, and you know, this has been the best month of our lives." And I heard that, and I thought, well, what the heck is that about? Like, I didn't have a model. I mean, I was a family practice resident. I was steeped in Maslow and Erickson and Piaget and all these developmentalists and family systems theory and all of this stuff. I didn't have a conceptual framework for somebody who knew they were dying saying, "I'm well, doctor," or a family saying, "This was the best month we can remember as adults." So, you know, frankly, I realized then the universe is trying to teach me something here. And I leaned into it. And it didn't change my career immediately. I mean, I went out and practiced rural family medicine for a while, but I always was doing a little hospice care on the side, trying to stand up a program wherever I was. And, you know, being the hospice doctor for the first decade, always as a volunteer, then I gradually I helped stand up the field and stayed involved
You became a leader, one of the American leaders in the hospice palliative field.
Yeah.
You don't have to say it. I'm saying it.
Not by design. It's because, you know, I think I have this unwholesome predilection for committee work. So I kept saying yes to various committees and writing white papers with people and, you know, about the ethics and practice of caring for people who are facing the end of life. But and hopefully we'll be able to explore this further, but I think my contribution has been, or at least my focus has been, to kind of explore the human potential for well-being at the far end of life. That's something that my own field has not done nearly a good enough job of really fleshing out. But this is not woo-woo, you know, new age psychology. This is anthropology. The fact is, you know, we have this human potential for well-being. Not everyone, of course. Some people, you know, suffer so terribly that well-being is out of reach. But it happens more often than most doctors and nurses and others recognize. We don't have language for it. And I've tried to, in my writing and my research and teaching, I've tried to sort of flesh out that human potential.
You know, that's really important because I interviewed Dame Cecily Saunders from one of my books, and she's the founder of the Modern Hospice Movement, who had kind of an experience like yours in terms of coming to this field. But she kind of created it. It was her genesis that she...
It was indeed.
And she gave me a half hour at St. Christopher's Hospice when she was in retirement. And
she not said easy that, to get, by the way.
I'm sorry?
I had the same privilege, but it's not easy to come by.
No, it wasn't. I was really honored. And she said that the problem with a hospice in the U.S. was that you require people to forego any kind of life-extending treatment we do in terms of Medicare and so forth. And she said, that's like saying, abandon hope, all ye who enter here, because some of the most important benefits of hospice come from the very thing you were talking about. That is the growth as you are entering your last stage of life. And I came up with a thought that, well, you know, hospice isn't about dying. It's really about living.
Yeah, it's about living fully. That's right. It is about living fully.
And my dad had that experience. He died in a hospice in 1984, but before the hospice, he was in the hospice facility. He was dying of cancer. He would go into the backyard, and my father was a great man. He was a Silver Star recipient from World War II and so forth. But when he got the cancer, he had been kind of braggadocio, that kind of a person. I saw him go within himself, and he would sit in the backyard on his bench and contemplate his life while looking at his beloved cactus garden. And I'm telling you, Ira, the day my dad died, he was a better man than he had been his whole life, and he'd been a wonderful man his whole life.
Yeah. You know, that's why I don't like the phrase good death. I think it conflates death, which is beyond life, a lifeless state, with dying, which is a part of living.
Right.
And I've seen people change in remarkable ways during the months, weeks, and even days before they take their last breath. That's something that in our culture we tend to ignore. But you know, so I mean, you mentioned in your nice introduction, I titled my first book Dying Well, which is a much better phrase than good death. When you hear dying well, you know, people first hear well as an adverb modifying the process of dying, which it is. But it's more provocative to hear that phrase and hear well as an adjective describing the person who is dying. For a person to die well, well within him or herself, right with themselves, right with the world, right with nature or their God, that's really gets to the remarkable, again, potential for living fully that we have as human beings.
And you see reconciliations with family who've been estranged. I've been a hospice volunteer, and I've seen all of these things.
Right.
And it's quite a remarkable thing. In fact, my last patient had ALS, and he told me, when you think about this ALS, he wouldn't have missed it for anything, is what he told me. Which you know, when you're not in that circumstance, kind of blows your mind.
It is mind-blowing, but again, it's not It's not pop psychology, it's anthropology. And for whatever reason, and I think there are a lot of reasons, but American medicine is so focused on problems and has become so transactional that through no ill intention, we doctors don't see positive experiences associated with illness and dying. And I mean that, you know, pretty literally. I mean, we literally don't recognize positive experiences associated with illness and dying because we've assumed that this time of life is about suffering or its avoidance. And that's the best we can hope for.
It's very interesting. I want to get into the problems that hospice is experiencing, but before we do that, let's talk about how it's supposed to work in an ideal setting. I remember when I was trained, and I guess I had about 8 weeks of training, once a week, there was an interdisciplinary team. So it's not just a matter of giving somebody morphine. There's a lot more to it than that. So would you describe how the interdisciplinary team works?
Sure. So back to Dame Cicely. You know, Dame Cicely was trained as a nurse before she hurt her back, and she became a social worker. And then she was always a very spiritual person. She was a deeply Anglican woman, and she was distressed by how she saw people dying in Britain. This is after World War II. And so she decided she had to become a doctor. So she, as she said, she read medicine and she became a doctor. So, you know, here she was, a nurse who became social worker, who became a doctor. On the way to inventing the interdisciplinary hospice team, she had become one, frankly.
Hey, that's interesting. Yeah.
And so this interdisciplinary team, which was what she described as a hospice team and has been encoded in America in law and regulation, is quite brilliant. There is a physician, social worker, nurses are predominant, always have been in hospice care, and a spiritual care person, a chaplain or other spiritual care provider. And I have to say that the whole is more than the sum of its parts. When I've been a hospice medical director, I leaned heavily into this ID team meeting, interdisciplinary team meeting, which could take place once a week, sometimes more often. And that's where every patient gets discussed and everybody's voice, every clinician's voice is heard. There's also volunteers involved in hospice program, and the volunteer coordinator comes to the ID team meeting and with notes from the volunteers so that everybody's perspective is heard. And really, that synergy is so remarkable. Sometimes the key to unlocking a patient's suffering comes from a bath aide who heard a remark about a patient who was worried about their daughter who didn't have childcare and therefore couldn't come and spend time with her, you know. And I remember once or twice in a IDT meeting thinking, well, who knew? You know, so we fix that. We address that problem and everything else settles down, right? There are some problems that morphine won't fix.
Yep.
Right? Childcare for a grandchild is something morphine's not going to fix, right? But that may be key to unlocking a patient's suffering.
Yeah. And I noticed, and again, you know, I just, as a volunteer, I noticed the amazing interaction among the various people who came. And one of the things that has always stayed with me, I did this in the 90s, so it's been a while, but I was a volunteer for a man who was dying of colon cancer. And what that they needed was me to do the housework because the wife was really freaked out about what was happening to her husband. And so I would come in and, you know, I'd wash the floors or, you know, volunteers do whatever is needed. And one day, one of the caregivers, I don't know what the title is, but the people who wash and take care of the patient came in, and she was this wonderful big African-American woman, and she was singing to the patient, and she was rubbing cream on his arms, and he was looking at her with such a sense of joy and gratitude mixed together, because he was being touched, he was being right. cared for. And I said, so you're hanging in, huh? And he goes, hanging in. So I mean, it really is, if you, I would urge anyone who, with a compassionate heart, to become a hospice volunteer, because you will see humanity in a way that you may not have seen in other experiences.
Yeah, beautiful story. Thanks for that. You're absolutely right. You said it better than I could.
My mother also died in hospice. She had Alzheimer's in 2016. And we brought her into our home, and she was with us for the last 5 months of her life. And I watched as the nurse came in and knew my mother so well, because every week that nurse would be there. And my mother wasn't in severe pain or anything, but she had a little bit of pain because she was failing to thrive and that stuff. But you had all kinds of people coming, fussing over my mother, which she loved the attention.
Of course. You know, the essence of human caring, I didn't learn in some textbook or from a physician mentor. I actually learned it from my mom and dad. When I was a young boy, I was probably 8 years old when my grandma Leah suffered a terrible stroke, a really big stroke, and was rendered paralyzed on one side, couldn't speak for many, many months. She was in a rehab facility in Newark, New Jersey. And we have gradually, as they did all that they could for her, they finally, you know, said, you know, we need to take her home. And my grandfather couldn't take care of her, so we took her home to Wanamassa, New Jersey. And and she lived with us for the next year or two. My mom cared for her mainly, but we were all very much part of taking care of Grandma Leah. When she eventually was well enough to live mostly independently and go back home with my grandfather, my father, who I have to say was kind of a big, burly kind of man, never finished high school. You know, he was a hardworking, lovely guy, but not refined. My father would twice a month go up, make the hour drive north to cut Leah's toenails. Mm. And I watched him multiple times. He made a ritual of it. He soaked her feet in soapy water while he kibitzed with her and told her bawdy jokes, and you know, they spend time together, and then he tenderly cut her toenails and do other things that she couldn't do for herself. And you know, I for me, that was role modeling that I couldn't have gotten elsewhere. And it stayed with me. It stays with me to this day.
We've talked about the nurse, who's the one who mostly interacts with the patient, right? She's the one who sees the patient once a week and probably reports back to the hospice physician. What is the role of the hospice physician?
Well, it's supposed to be the medical captain of the team. I mean, nurses are predominant, no question, and that's a good thing. But there are a lot of patients, and nurses need the support of physicians. I mean, think about it. If you know, hospice patients are pretty much by definition the sickest patients in the healthcare system, right? And they deserve some involvement by the most highly trained professionals in the healthcare system. Nurse practitioners these days do a brilliant job of extending physicians, as do physician assistants. But there are some syndromes and some situations where there is no substitute for having a physician involved. So the physician is an active member of the interdisciplinary team, helps manage medications, helps with the care plans, helps develop, you know, treatments, whether they involve prescription meds or physical therapy and wound management and all things of that nature. And is there to, you know, support not only nurses, but the rest of the team to make home visits whenever necessary, to be there in a moment at a crisis. I mean, you know, as a hospice medical director, as much as I don't like taking call, I was on call 24/7 when I was a hospice medical director. And I never minded, by the way, you know, hospice call was always for me, not burdensome, interestingly. If a hospice nurse needed me, first, since they were nurses I worked with, I knew that the question was going to be an appropriate one and not, you know, not a waste of my time. But I would be there. Now, scrolling forward, among the problems that are plaguing hospice in America today is a disappearance of physicians. Mm. Physicians, I mean, there are so many programs now where there is one physician for, you know, 200 or 300 patients, and the physician is hired or contracted for a certain number of hours per week, and basically told to show up, sit down, shut up, and sign, because that signature of a physician is still required for Medicare certification, a short way of saying to get paid. And that's, you know, I'm seeing this across the country where physicians are involved sort of in name only.
Yeah, that would be a real problem. Just going back to my own experience with my mother, she had sundowning. And, you know, in the daytime, she'd be this sweet little old lady with a poor memory. And at nighttime, all hell would break loose. And we needed to treat her with some medication for that. And every time, it was almost like the Alzheimer's was a living thing, because every time it would be controlled, it would find a way around. And we'd have to do something different, adjust it in some way. And the hospice physician actually called in mental health specialists to help us. And so we were able to keep, you know,
right,
going and help my mother not go through too much of that. And ourselves, by the way, to go through too much of that, because it was very difficult for us too. And if the doctor can't, if that doctor hadn't been able to talk to me and then get me to the right person, I don't know what would have happened.
So here's the cruel irony of the situation. Nowadays, with the corporatization of hospice care, there are more than a few. It's not uncommon anymore for hospice physicians within their contractual employment agreements to basically be disallowed from seeing hospice patients, from direct patient care. It's not part of their job description to provide direct patient care. The cruel irony is that back in the day, you know, in the late 1970s and early 1980s, we created hospice in America partly to remove the barriers that were keeping hospice patients from seeing physicians. There was a time back in that period where physicians sort of signed off and hospice patients no longer had access to physicians. Now scroll forward, 40 years? And hospice has become the barrier to dying patients seeing physicians.
And I know you've been writing about this, which was one of the reasons I asked you to come back on the podcast, because hospice is such an essential service. One more question about how hospice works, and then we're going to get into some of the problems that you've been addressing more deeply. I read in one of the pieces that there are four levels of hospice care.
Yeah.
I think it would be well valuable for people to know what those four levels were
Oh,
and
sure.
how they're decided upon.
Well, sure. So the in in the United States, hospice is a home care sport, right? You mentioned, you know, hospice facility, but hospice facilities are quite unusual these days, and they always have been in the United States. Hospice began as a facility-based service in England, and you know, Dame Cicely's time, she had St. Christopher's Hospice, which still exists, and it's a place. And there are hospice facilities in America, but they're you know, quite few and far between. Hospice is like home care on steroids, where there is this interdisciplinary team, mostly around nursing visits, and that's, you know, 98% of hospice care is routine home care. There is three other levels, though. There are two intensive levels of hospice care, which is continuous home care, which has strict regulatory requirements under Medicare. But if somebody is having a symptom crisis and needs a nurse in the home for six or more hours a day, and they need frequent changes in medications and careful observation, they can qualify for continuous home care, which is paid at a significantly higher rate than routine home care and is available. And then there's general inpatient hospice care, which can only be provided in a hospital, in a hospice facility, or in some nursing homes that have staffing to qualify. And that's paid similar to, and actually a little higher even than, continuous home care, but is similarly for patients who can't be maintained at home and for at least a day or two need this intensive level of hospice care. And then the fourth one is called respite care for patients whose family is called away for some reason, or is so stressed that they need help. And so for, you know, 5 days or so, a patient can be moved to either a hospice facility or a nursing home, so to give the family time to catch their breath and for new supports to be placed in the home so they can go back to a routine home care level of hospice care. It's important to mention that those four levels of care were written into the statute, into the federal law that created the hospice Medicare benefit. It also, let me just go one step further and say that today, somewhere around 53% of American hospice programs do not provide either continuous home care or general inpatient care, in flagrant violation of that law. How can that be?
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask.
I wonder myself how that can be.
So I'm skipping ahead a bit in my mind. If a family is in a situation where they really think that continuous care is required, and the hospice doctor would say, yes, but it isn't available, what do they do? Who do they complain to?
Well, they suffer. They suffer for unmet needs. They can be admitted to a hospital, which is often what happens. And some unscrupulous programs, and there are more than a few, will summarily discharge a patient from hospice and send them to an emergency department, where they are then admitted to an acute care hospital for their symptom needs or whatever, which, you know, is just a whisker away from patient abandonment, in my mind.
Yeah. You wrote an article, and for listeners who want to read it, it will be linked in the program notes to this podcast, which I thought was quite an extraordinary title. The hospice industry needs major reforms. It should start with an apology.
Yeah.
As one of the leaders of the hospice movement, one of the people who helped create this whole system and certainly popularize it, because I've known your work for decades, why did you feel the need to write such an extraordinary titled article?
Because that's what respectable, responsible people do. When you've screwed up, when you've done something that you now realize was wrong, you start with an apology. In my field, in hospice and palliative medicine, we have watched the corporatization of our field erode staffing levels and our responses in emergencies and our responses to patients' unmet needs. For years, we have known that some programs, and now it's becoming quite a few programs, are not well serving dying patients and their families, and that frankly, some hospice programs are misrepresenting themselves to enroll patients who either don't qualify for hospice and should continue to be served by the straight Medicare disease management parts of our system, or others that are simply not well enough staffed or managed to meet patients' needs. And we've stood by quietly while this was unfolding. And now it's become a true crisis. And, you know, there's been exposés, the most famous one in ProPublica and The New Yorker, that exposed blatant fraud and abuse in quite a few hospice programs, and not as a flaw, but as kind of part of the design of some of these publicly traded or private equity owned hospice corporations. And even then, in the days after that New Yorker ProPublica article came out, the first response from the leaders of the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization or the Academy of Hospice and Palliative Medicine was, oh, the media has it wrong. They're dumping on us. These are just a few bad apples. And I and a few other, you know, gray-haired senior influentials in the field were outraged. And we said publicly, are you kidding me? We've been standing by and talking about this behind doors for years. It's time to come clean, guys. We have to start with an apology and then reset ourselves.
This brings something up. By the way, if people want to read that a New Yorker article, it will be, it's linked in the program notes. But what you were saying is that rather than being advocates for the patients and their families, they became, as we've seen in so many institutions these days, self-protecting, going into a crouch, hiding under their desk because they didn't want to harm the reputation that was being harmed, because people aren't idiots and people talk to each other if they have these very bad experiences. But it was institutional protection instead of patient protection. Sounds to me like what you're saying.
Exactly what it was. And, you know, I've come out very loudly, and I've been saying this, by the way, for a long time behind closed doors, that that hospice nice has to stop at patient harm, for heaven's sakes.
Yeah.
Right? Collegiality needs to stop at culpability, at criminality. And the hospice associations, which are supposed to provide leadership, have been co-opted because now their boards of directors are representing, you know, some of their boards of directors are populated by some of the culpable major corporations. So this just has to stop. And I'm old enough and my, you know, career is far enough along that I don't really care if I, you know, piss people off.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, because, you know, people need to be made aware that this is happening. And the powers that be, these institutions, have to stop protecting themselves and start fulfilling their purpose, which is to protect the patients. Now, after this came out, and I was in reading in your article, they finally, the powers that be, came together with a bunch of recommendations. So right. Now this is about 2 years ago or so. Just because of time factors, what were a few of those recommendations, and how satisfied are you that these recommendations are being implemented?
The recommendations were excellent. They were about increasing surveys by Medicare of programs, tightening standards for the surveyors to use in finding programs and the like, pausing new Medicare certifications in regional hotbeds of fraud and abuse, all of this. I have to say a couple of things about this. First, I read none of those recommendations that couldn't have been made a decade ago. All of us knew that this was emerging and should have been done a decade ago. And the second thing I would say is when the associations that lead a healthcare industry's response to a problem is to send a letter to Congress, you know that you've got real issues. Yeah. That if that's all they can do, we're in deep doo-doo. What I've said internally for a long time, and now I've started to say it to the publicly, is that there has always been plenty that we as a professional field and the associated industries could do to protect the public. We don't have to police ourselves even. It's not up to us to file charges or to condemn, but we could create clear standards for hospice programs for their structure, their staffing, and their caseloads, and emergencies for their operations, for the roles of physicians, all of that sort of stuff. We haven't done that. All of these years, the industry has never stood up and done that. We could establish good housekeeping seals of approval,
right,
or, you know, blue ribbons and, you know, various different, whatever it is. It could be bronze, gold, and platinum, whatever, to hold out what we feel are excellence, you know, criteria for excellence. I mean, the public needs to be able to separate not only the good from the bad, but the excellent from the mediocre.
And you could have an accreditation system that would, if people want the business, they're going to want to get the highest level, let's say a platinum level of service, and right, then they'll get more business and the money will follow.
So that's the point. I mean, even Milton Friedman would have said that for free markets to work, the markets have to be free.
Yeah. Right?
What we have today are markets that aren't working because the criteria for excellence have been obscured, right? The public doesn't know. Instead, competition happens through corporate deals and bargains and discounts and affiliations that leave out the sort of competition based on quality that would actually help drive the healthcare industry in general, but certainly my own field of hospice and palliative care, toward demanding excellence. It would fail without excellence.
So if a listener is entering this circumstance where they or a family member or loved one are going to require hospice services, what are some of just a few? I know we can't do them all, but a few of the things that they should look for, the most important ones in your view.
Ask who owns the hospice program. In general, while there are some very good for-profit hospice programs, in general, lean toward the long-term community-based nonprofit hospice programs who've been in business for a long time. That's helpful. If it's a for-profit program, you want a for-profit program that's owned by a family, not publicly traded or owned by a private equity firm. Find out ask how many patients our hospice nurse will be seeing at any given time.
What would be a good number for someone to think would be appropriate?
12, no more than 14. These days, there are some programs, quite a few programs, where the hospice nurse is seeing 15 to 18 to 20 patients on any given, you know, week of his or her work, which is too many for any mortal human being to see. Find out, ask directly, will a physician be visiting us at home under hospice care? who will we see if our hospice nurse is away and can't see us? Who do we call with urgent questions or problems? What happens if the medications we've been given stop working? What is our crisis management plan? Is there a dedicated hospice facility available if we need one? Those are the sort of questions I would ask. I mean, we're at a situation today where, you know, let's face it. I mean, let the dyer beware, right? We really have to be consumers in the most active sense, even when it comes to hospice care.
So would most patients and families find more than one hospice in a given area so that they can compare and contrast, or are they going to be stuck with whichever one it is?
Except in rural areas, there's usually more than one. And even in relatively rural areas, nowadays, there are many. Many in some areas, there are so many that have cropped up in the last decade that it's darn near scary. And they haven't cropped up because of population-based needs. They popped up because of greed, because those Medicare reimbursements have been seen as a way for corporations to make money. Here in Missoula, Montana, for 10 years, I was the medical director of the only hospice program, a community-based nonprofit. It still exists, but now there are five other hospice programs, and you have to work really hard to even figure out who owns those hospice programs. A couple of them are owned by multinational corporations.
Okay, so I would hope that the patient's own physician, who has to prescribe hospice, right?
A physician has to certify. It was supposed to be, in the initial design, the patient's primary care physician. But, you know, in 21st century America, not all patients even have a primary care physician.
Yeah.
A licensed physician has to certify that the patient has a prognosis of 6 months to live or less, quote, if the disease runs its natural course.
And hopefully that the physician who does that signing off would have some knowledge about what are the better hospices and what are the lesser hospices.
Well, yes, but that physician may have a sideline contract with one of the lesser hospices. It's ugly, Wes.
That is ugly.
You know, you look at LA County or Orange County, and it is beyond the Wild West. It's like, you know, it's like Deadwood out there. There are over 800 hospice programs in LA County. Last I saw one count of over 1,200 programs in Orange in LA County. Now, that's more than all of the programs in the state of Florida, right? I know of, because I lived in LA for quite a few years, I know of three hospice programs in LA that I would confidently refer patients to.
That's really, considering the size of LA, and I lived there, you know, for the first 42 years of my life, that's pretty shocking.
It's chilling.
Yeah,
it's
just it really is.
And by the way, and, you know, here I am talking about it, but you got to know that the boards of directors of the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization, which is now the National Alliance for Care at Home, and the American Academy of Hospice and Palliative Medicine, they all know this too. Nothing has changed since they sent their 32 recommendations to Congressman Blumenauer, who's now retired, 2 years ago. Nothing really has changed.
So in other words, you're telling me that the recommendations that were issued that you said were excellent have not been basically pursued, and that there's no leading statesperson or politician in Congress that's leading this charge to reform these problems.
I would say Medicare has put a pause on some in the states of Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, and California. They have paused new Medicare certifications. The Office of the Inspector General has brought suits against a small handful of hospice programs. But in general, on a large scale, no, basically nothing has changed. And I think the dodge here, which just drives me crazy, is that the field, those of us who are professionals who are supposed to be leading the field, have kept saying, well, this is Congress's job, or this is Medicare's job, when really it's first and foremost our job. We could at least be setting standards. You know, we could be adopting a zero tolerance stance so that we developed or at least contributed to hotlines so that when we suspect fraud and abuse, we, again, I said collegiality needs to stop at criminality. You know, we need to turn in some of these programs that, not for our own sake, but because they are preying on the most vulnerable patients in the healthcare system.
It seems to me that hospice offers existential benefits beyond mere symptom relief. Could you comment on that, please?
The reason I changed careers, you know, and was drawn into the field of hospice and palliative care is because this notion of human potential through the end of life feels like it ought to be the next big thing in American culture, right? And it turns out that while medicine and the healthcare professions in general are critically important to preserving people's opportunity to live fully through the end of life by managing symptoms, by making sure that what we're doing is consistent with what people value most in their personal lives, all of that, that there is something culturally important, that it turns out that beyond the problem-based model of medicine, that there is an opportunity to foster well-being through the end of life, to make sure that people are warm and dry, that they are provided something always to eat and drink, that they are helped for those who cannot feed themselves, to helped to eat and drink, that we can help people and guide them through this difficult phase of life that needs some guidance, because people have not thought often about how to complete their affairs, how to, as you mentioned, mend relationships with people they love or once loved. Perhaps it's a spouse that they were married to for 20 years before a bitter divorce. When one or the other is now facing life's end, it may matter to them to get back in touch, to know what to say. You know, I wrote a book called The Four Things Before Goodbye. Please forgive me. I forgive you. Thank you, and I love you. Right?
You said you wanted to discuss the Human Caring Project. Please do.
Of course. And the ability to honor and celebrate people. You know, that's why human caring preserves human potential through the end of life. And that extends not only from the individual, but to those who love that person. That's why, you know, we hold vigils. We throw going away parties for people. We sometimes, you know, we wake them from life using the Irish, you know, tradition before they die, right? We hold celebrations of life. We acknowledge the fullness of the human condition that is quite remarkable. And so I really do believe that as I'm, you know, entering the last phase of my career, that I would like to help the culture grow the rest of the way up. You know, we're going to die, right? We should acknowledge it and get over it. And then turn attention to living as fully as possible, as joyfully as possible, together through this remarkable gift that is human life.
Ira, thank you for being on the podcast, and thank you for all the services that you've offered in your career to suffering people.
Thank you, Wes. It's been a real privilege, a gift to me to be able to devote my time and work and creative energies in this field of human caring. It's given me so much, and I hope I've been able to contribute to something that does become the next big thing in American culture.
Thanks for listening to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. Discover all the good work of the Center on Human Exceptionalism by visiting discovery.org/human. We can only do this work, speaking on behalf of human life, human thriving, and our exceptional place in this world and our cosmos, with your support. We invite you to make a one-time gift today and to consider starting a monthly gift to support the Center on Human Exceptionalism and this show. Wherever you're listening to Humanize, please take a moment to rate and review the show. You matter. Your actions matter. Be bold, be exceptional, and be back soon.